Splendid. Many thanks indeed. OK, we're off again on another Midweek Drive Live, in which in the studio we have a trio of terrific wonderfulness, starting off, of course, with Darren Scales. Darren Scales, welcome back to your first post-pandemic Midweek Drive Live.
Hello, it's good to be here. It's like nothing's ever changed, almost.
Yeah, it's just wonderful. Although there are a few differences, as I'm sure you'll note, including the fact that we have Afrobeats presenter extraordinaire and general postgraduate student, the wonderful Tosin Shojemi, with us as well. Tosin, how are you?
Good, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm okay, all things considered. And keeping the international theme going from the joys of Romania, Bucharest, to be precise, a kind of bigger version of Lincoln, for the people who are a bit concerned about that. Anna Coscadel, back with us again. How are you, Anna?
Hi, Alex. I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. And is your mum still using these shows as ways to teach English?
Well, I do hope so, because I sent her the link.
Marvellous. This is very important. Back with us after several false starts, of course, in London, Anna Lewis. How are you, Anna?
Absolutely fine. Glad to be back.
Yeah, absolutely. And sadly, we have to say get well soon to Jessica Burtis, because she's a bit poorly in North Carolina, but that's okay. Now, we have a very special guest who I've saved to the end here, because it's a whole narrative here, which I think is going to be cinematic, Daz, because I know, obviously, you're a filmmaker. You put that
there's drama. There's definitely drama.
There's drama. There's scandal. There are spiders. You know, you have somebody who's an associate professor of behavioral ecology in Canada, the research chair in biological dystopias at McMaster University in Canada, generally a fantastic individual, and then it all goes wrong. Professor Jonathan Pruitt, welcome to the Midweek Drive Live. And again, as I say, it all goes wrong. Maybe it all goes right. You know, the fact that basically your career came crashing down a couple of years ago in 2020. Maybe this is all part and parcel of the career. Would you be on the Midweek Drive Live if that wasn't the case?
Yeah, you know, I doubt I would be here for as long, or be able to provide such an interesting and dynamic story.
Well, I mean, I read this and my jaw proceeded to drop considerably as I see the whole sort of package here. I mean, in fact, I'm going to ask you to share with us, because obviously there are a number of people. We've got some wonderful scholars in the studio here. We've got, you know, postgraduate students. We've got undergraduate students. We've got Anna Lewis, who's a researcher. I mean, Anna, you've never lied in your research, have you?
Absolutely not.
And it kind of, this is that sort of thing where, you know, you think, why would you do that? I mean, I could probably suggest, I can make lots of speculation. Is it pressure of publication? Is it a case of working through that? But you already had a track. You published more than 140 groundbreaking papers about the effects of environmental disasters on spider colonies. Take us through your story, Jonathan. You know, where did it all start to unfold and reform in another manner?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess the general idea was that I had a successful early career as a spider biologist, and I studied the way that spiders, which are normally solitary organisms, how they evolve sociality and how they can live in groups and what allows some of those groups to prevail and others to wither and die. And the general scheme is that, you know, that was all lovely, and I published many dozens of papers over the years, approaching on 200. And, you know, I've been headhunted by several universities, and, you know, and I had an aptitude for executing lots of studies and studies that were successful in landing in top tier journals. And then the idea is that around 2020, it emerged that in at least three of my articles, that there were these giant copy and paste events. So like the exact same sequence of numbers. And these were like, so what I was measuring is if you frighten a spider, basically how long it remains hidden and tries to, it feels intimidated by a stimulus, and then how quickly thereafter it resumes its normal activity. And I basically was giving little spiders personality tests and then figuring out, you know, who does what jobs inside of these societies. Well, it turns out these little personality assays I was executing on these spiders, I would get the exact same values in my data set in the exact same order. Mm-hmm. And that can't be there procedurally. And so there are a couple of hypotheses as to why that would be. Some people thought I was deliberately manipulating results. So like these values, these little personality tests on spiders, I was taking the same values and moving them around so that I could engineer certain kinds of outcomes in my studies and help them land in top tier journals. Other people thought that they could have been errors, but then if so, then they were at least sloppy and they're not the sort of things that you would expect from normal scientists. And then a huge controversy exploded all over Twitter. It's called like Pruittgate or Spidergate or Pruitt data, a million different hashtags. And soon, like, you know, 100,000 or more people were following this story. And it was around the same time that the pandemic was, you know, passing through the United States. And so people were voracious for content. And this thing got all over the internet and then in major scientific journals. And I was forced to retract a very large number of articles because, it, you know, I shouldn't say that large, but, you know, almost 10% of the articles I ever wrote were compromised.
Yeah, 16 I'm gone out of 140. Yeah. So you're right. I mean, over 10% from that
line. Like, 170.
Okay, fair enough.
Sorry.
Now, I mean, again, one of the lines I was talking about this with Daz earlier, I mean, we're academics at the University of Lincoln, and clearly that's Lincoln, England, as opposed to Lincoln, Nebraska, just to be clear. In terms of the sequence there, I mean, Daz, being honest as an academic, I mean, we hammer it home with our students, that's all. I mean, I'll bring our team in a few moments, but it is something which plagiarism is not just frowned upon, but it's a very serious offence. It's intellectual theft.
Well, it is serious, but it's a bit of a minefield as well at the same time, because there's you know, intentional, then there's, you know, hypothetical, okay. And in terms of, you know, taking data, looking at data, looking at other people's work, looking at your own work, and especially when you're doing, you know, large amounts of data accumulation and stuff, it can be very simple to err. And then, of course, if you haven't realized that, or, you know, moving forwards, and then of course you talk to students about, well, when do they know, when do they say, when are they going to fess up and say, look, you know, this isn't right, this has gone wrong, and the impact of that, plus all the student stresses that they have at the same time. And then, of course, like what Jonathan has been saying there, you have, you know, something gate, you know, it gets out, even if it's within a micro community within the university or your colleagues, and there's that pressure on, you know, on top of the students as well, so it can really sort of snowball.
I mean, this is the point, Jonathan. Did you feel at the time that you were at the centre of a storm? Was there a calm at the centre of the storm? Did you actually go from what the flip to, you know, this is outrageous, to feeling rightly indignant about the whole thing? Or was it just a case of, oh, well, it's my fault?
At no point did I feel indignant. I mean, like, the reality is that people trust scientists to be rigorous, right? Like, they when people in their mind's eye, when people aren't academics, or they in their mind's eye, they think of scientists as being these very careful people who are laborious, who are not attention seeking, who are not trying to be entrepreneurial. They're not thinking about what journals they're going to submit to or how much attention they're going to get. And scientists need to occupy a role like that. We shouldn't be entrepreneurial. We shouldn't be thinking about how much attention we can obtain for our work if we have outcome A, B, or C. And, you know, my defense in this whole ordeal was that, you know, if you quantify how much of the data were included in these copy and paste events, or in two articles they found simulated values, it turns out to be like 1 or 2% of the total data. And even in spite of that, this was enough to trigger outrage and distrust across the entire community and outside of the community as well. And even though when you expunge these values, I mean, just because it's 1% doesn't mean that it wasn't able to manipulate the results. If you expunge any of the values that had a question mark over them, the statistics basically work out the exact same. We get the exact same results. And so on the one hand, I thought to myself, like, wow, do people really think that I was fabricating, you know, 2% of the data poorly for no inferential gain? And why would they think that? But, you know, that was a mistake on my part. Like, the whole point was not that they thought that those were data manipulation in and of themselves, but that either the rigor or the trust in the process that produced those data was therefore compromised. And that's what swept a large number of articles, even some articles that have very, very modest issues with them, got retracted and got disposed of. I mean, and on the one hand, I felt, you know, I felt sorry for myself at points of that. But on the other hand, like, that's kind of science doing its job, right? Like, if something does have a question mark over it, and for me, it's true that several of my articles I was in favor of retracting, but the scientific community, if there's a question mark over something, they want to make sure that they're moving forward with due diligence and rigor. And, you know, am I a victim of that? Well, no. But was I subject to it? Yes. And, you know, I can feel sorry for myself all day long, but the reality is the scientific community did what it should. The errors were prone enough that it cost me my job and most of my professional connections, the sense of self. But
I mean, was there a sense of being struck with the mark of Cain that actually this came through? I mean, I'm looking at the notion, you know, shamed scientist opens up for the first time about the academic scandal that destroyed his career and shocked the world. Okay, on the one hand, that's classic clickbait. So, you know, that's like catnip for most radio presenters to say, ooh, we must do a feature on that then. But was it something that you felt as though guilty by association, that your colleagues, your peers, people who would have been reviewing papers suddenly were backing off and you thought, okay, is this, am I having to reset my professional and personal boundaries here?
Yeah, I mean, do I think that that part of it was like that people had an image in my mind that became more and more demonized or more and more villainous?
Were you seen as toxic, Jonathan? Were you seen as a toxic individual? You know, people didn't want to associate with you.
I, I was. I still am. I mean, there are people who are.
That's why you're on Zoom. You see, we couldn't have you in the studio. Brand contamination.
So I mean, I still have former colleagues that contact me. We chit chat all the time. But like, they're very careful. They will not make a public statement that they're even in communication with me any longer. Yeah. So that, you know, that whole villain element, that whole infamy, is something that still resonates very strongly. Sure. And the thing is, I can write a blog post, a totally innocent blog post, and the next thing you know, one of my colleagues will call me and say, "You're on Twitter again," and 50,000 people will have observed something from my blog post where I think I'm talking to nobody. And to some degree, that could make you sad. You're like, okay, well,
Jonathan, it's X these days anyway, so don't worry about Twitter. That's a different scenario.
Completely different beast now.
let's turn to some of our team here. Anna, I know you've been giving some due thought and diligence to this. Any questions you'd like to put into the mix at present for Jonathan?
Yes, I do have a question, actually. I know that you're also a writer, so I wanted to ask you about the fact when you were writing your papers, your academic papers, do you feel like you were writing from a scientist perspective or a fan fiction writer perspective, or it was both combined?
Well, I mean, so I guess... So I think one of my academic advisor in undergrad and graduate school basically said, she's like, you write like you're writing for the Scientific Inquirer. So I oftentimes, you know, any result that I got, I'm like, okay, how can I spin this interesting result into being the most engaging narrative possible? I mean, scientists are, you know, just passionate or not, we're also storytellers. And so like, when you get a set of results, you need to kind of come up with a narrative, a model of how you think these results could make sense. So, you know, and much of that model is guessed indirectly based on the available evidence in front of you. So did I think of myself as a fiction author then? No, but I'll tell you, when I write fiction now, man, it is imbued by that scientific perspective. So like, when I write something that's fiction now, it's almost surgical and blistering. And I think that's because of my history as being a scientist, where you have very few words. So if I write a fantasy novel, it's per unit of time, per unit word, every single sentence gets a strip search in a way that would never have happened if I hadn't been a battle-hardened academic for decades.
Of course, Michael Crichton being a good example of somebody who crossed over effectively, but without, I think, falsifying results. Over to Anna Lewis. Anna, again, as a historian, as a graduate with respect to this, I mean, again, you can see the reverberations going throughout the whole system. Any questions or thoughts from yourself for Jonathan?
One of the things that's come up recently in surveys that I've been doing online is the role of AI in a lot of the academic world. And I wondered whether your guest has a perspective on AI and its use.
Yeah, could you not have blamed it all on ChatGPT, Jonathan? So it wasn't me, it was the computer what made me do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, on the one hand, AI is an incredibly powerful tool, and its ability to... not necessarily create, but amalgamate ideas from people and make connections in disparate works and ideas, and I mean, it's very impressive. But I would say one of the frightening things about me, so ChatGPT and whatnot sort of emerged in the distal half of my scandal. But I mean, I thought to myself like, oh my, I mean, I had random number generators when I was working on these spider papers. If I'd wanted to make up values of a specified distribution and have there be a significant difference in the mean, I could just have Excel or any number of stats programs spit out random numbers. You don't have to copy and paste anything. But you know, still, like, they're at, with ChatGPT, you don't even know how to tell a program how to make up data. Now you could have ChatGPT do it. The nice thing is that, like, at least ChatGPT, I think it tattles on itself. So if you ask ChatGPT, did you come up with these values, or at least this text, I think ChatGPT will tattle on itself.
It's probably when we reach version 5 and 6, it'll learn to lie as well. That'll be the ultimate test of, of exceeding Turing, etc. Let's turn to Tosin. Tosin, you've just completed, obviously, your master's work, your dissertation, and so on. Obviously, you had to sign to say it's all effectively your authentic work, etc. Yeah. What questions have you got for Jonathan?
Oh, I have, like, the first question is, this is such an interesting, like, thing to talk about. Like, I've Netflix come to you to make a documentary, because you need to make a documentary about this. It's actually really interesting. And the second thing is the way you were moved away from your academic side, like, by lecturers, by people in the academic institutions and everything. Do you think there's ever a way back from that situation where you can get on the good side of, because obviously it was a big deal and it was on Twitter and everything, but do you think there is a way back from that situation and
is there a route from perdition, basically?
Yeah.
A route not to perdition, but from perdition. Can you see, I mean, because you're teaching at the present, and I'd be intrigued to see, do your students know about your background? Do the parents of your students know? Because I can see a scenario here where they say, what? We can't have somebody who's telling untruths to us as teacher?
Yeah, that's right. So a couple of things here. One, I mean, at multiple points in the Pruitt-Gate ordeal, I saw opportunities to either short-circuit processes or just to mount a very strong defense. Like the fact that quantitatively I had a pretty strong defense. They don't change the results. They're 1% of the data, blah, 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 blah. There are multiple instances where I could have basically jammed myself, I think, wedged myself into place and prevented me from being ousted. But the problem with that is that the scientific ordeal, at least from a research perspective, operates on the honor system. So like once you've got a giant storm cloud over your head, like, could I continue to publish papers? Yeah. Would people have trusted them? No. So like what would be the point of continuing to try to ice skate uphill, basically, so that what I can sort of death rattle on and be a nuisance to a group of people who, even if these people threw me away, I still care for them. I still like science. I still think it's got an important niche. And now I just teach about it. And you know, on the one hand, that's sad. I don't get to contribute to the dialogue of science any longer, although, you know, I'm still cited many hundreds of times a year from articles that are not contested. But, you know, on the other hand, teaching about science, having the experience that I do, I think allows me to be a more effective lecturer. When I talk about things like ethics, the kids love it. Like, I don't have skeletons in my closet any longer. If I meet some gentleman off of Tinder, one of the first things I tell them is that I was like, hey, heads up, I have a giant academic scandal in my past, and so if that's going to be a red flag, toodaloo bugaloo. And I tell my students, too, like, you know, if this is my history, I'd much rather be... can I say the word? I'd much rather be imperiled by undue honesty now in my life than trying to conceal anything. I do not like the notion of concealing anything any longer, even if
the truth will set you free. I mean, it's interesting, of course, he's talking about
it set me free.
Well, after a fashion. And it also, there is this notion about obviously the more you lie, I mean, surely politicians use that as a career resume startup. The better liar you are, the better politician you are. Or maybe not. Let's turn it to Amanda. I mean, welcome back to the Midweek Drive Live. Amanda, I don't know if you've followed the actual story here. Any questions from yourself from the point of view of a creative writer and obviously a journalist as well?
Hi, Jonathan. I think in the discussion, I think plagiarism sort of struck to me in the sense that for my degree where it's English and you do a lot of seminar discussion based, and there is a little bit of fear of people not wanting to openly discuss because they worry that, oh, someone's going to plagiarize my idea, and especially in a subject where originality is so highly prized. And even again going through about different ways of how you can accidentally, you know, say self-plagiarism or whatnot, it's again like in group work, again it's the fear of, oh, I don't want to like contribute this because when we have to write a reflective report they could take this idea, so it's sort of that it creates that inhibition perhaps.
Is there a kind of problem with respect to the whole issue of trust in academia ultimately, Jonathan, that maybe that's at the root of the kind of challenges that you're faced with?
Yeah, I mean, so I have to say that I enjoyed the benefit of being a very fast moving individual. Like I run a half marathon every day, blah, blah, blah. I move very swiftly. I have lots of energy. I was never afraid of someone poaching my ideas because I find that the academic enterprise moves so slowly that the moment that you have an idea...
Surely not. I mean, that's not the case in Britain, is it? We're not a slow moving scenario. I'll be kidding.
Yeah, it takes a long time for something to come to fruition, turn into an experiment, turn to a paper. But I mean, from a literary perspective, yeah, if you have a neat idea and somebody has more power or has a bigger platform than you, then even if you're the first person to come up with an idea and publish it, if a bigger entity in the scientific sphere addresses the exact same question, even if you were the first one to do it, they will become the name known for it. Was that ever an issue for me personally, like where I felt imperiled? No, but did I see things like that happen? Yes. And that it's an interesting storyline that happens again and again and again, where even if ideas aren't poached beforehand, they're poached thereafter, and the more powerful lab and the more powerful personality becomes known for it, and those asymmetries shouldn't exist.
Jonathan, we're moving on now to your new work as an author of dark fantasy fiction. Darren Scales here is a director and producer and creator of a whole dark universe of matter and so on. Tell us a bit about that. How much can you actually share with us, and how can people actually follow your new life?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, like, let's see. So, no surprise. So, I thought, well, what am I going to do if everyone thinks that everything I say is a lie from here on out? Like, what do you do with the rest of your life?
It's like an episode of iMUD, basically Star Trek. If everything you say is a lie, I am lying. You know, Norman will coordinate.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, like, the benefit of fantasy is that it's already clearly a lie. This thing is not real. But so I thought, like, I'm going to continue to indulge in another kind of love, an aspect of my life. And that was, you know, I've always read fantasy novels when I was in the field. And so now I have started to compose them. And, of course, I wrote an academic setting because, realistically, that's all I've ever known since I was a child. I've been in school or part of a school in some way. And because I was like, wouldn't it be hilarious if the evil spider biologist thrown out of academia basically wrote about evil academics in giant towers, and that's what I ended up writing. And of course, it's obtained me a lot of attention, and it obtained the books a lot of attention, and for that I'm thankful. And it's already sparked a fair bit of outrage online that I would even dare to approach such a thing. And you know, I think of it as the scientific community took a lot of things that I liked about myself and gave me a bunch of infamy, and these dark fantasy books have allowed me to turn that infamy into other kinds of currencies that again give me a sense of self again and identity. So you can follow me the Shadows of the Monolith.com is my website for the series. The first book, The Amber Menhir, M-E-N-H-I-R. People in America don't know what menhirs are, but you guys in Europe actually have them, those standing stones that are ancient and designate that there have been people or cultures there from the past. But The Amber Menhir is the first book in the series. It came out a couple of weeks ago. It debuted as a bestseller, I think in part because people were interested to see what the evil spider biologist wrote. Mm-hmm. And it's been a fun ride, but it follows a bunch of students in a tower filled with vampiric intellectuals that have convinced the world that it's in danger, and the only way to save it is magic.
I thought that was a drama documentary. I mean, you know, vampiric intellectuals. I mean, it's the Romanian passage writ for large, basically, surely. Anna, you were nodding when you thought of Menhir there. Are you a Menhir fan as well as Tombstones? Anna Lewis. She's frozen. Is she frozen? Oh, what the heck. Anyway, further questions from Anna.
I'm listening intently. I'm aware there's two Anna. Yeah, the Menhir thing sounds very interesting because when I was a child, there was a program called Children of the Stones, and it was quite scary. It involved a lot of cultural. I think it was set in Scotland, where there were sort of like legends and things like that. But I think the notion of turning it on its head and actually making academics look more demonic than spiders is actually really appealing.
Yeah.
Coming from a background where there was some lecturers who scared me to death.
No, so, you know, London University wasn't that bad, Anna, please. You know, maybe in your sector, but in chemistry, biology, it was. If I said Chris Imodio, you'd be perfectly happy. Anyway, enough of such stuff. Hopefully he's still there. He was also an Arsenal supporter. Very strange. Anyway, finally, in terms of lines and coordination, etc., having gone through this, Jonathan, is it a case of you've taken those spider lemons and you've brought back some wonderful spider lemonade? Any regrets whatsoever? Are you quite happy with how things are panning out? And is this a case of a whole new chapter in your life experience and journey is beginning to unfold?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, like, it's hard to feel sorry for myself, and like, I feel like I've obtained a large amount of interesting life experiences that I've turned into a new version of myself. And the old version of me isn't dead. I didn't change my name. I didn't change my social media.
You weren't tempted to go Dr. Otto Octavius, perhaps, as a
not today. Not okay. Yet. But, okay. You know, you can't sever yourself from your past. But you know, there are a lot of people that were that spent a lot of hours devoted to this and were harmed tangentially through the giant scandal. Who had no wrongdoing and were victims. And although in some of those relationships I've recovered them and I've made amends, and in others there are still people who feel hurt and rightfully feel so and are wronged. And you know, I will spend the rest of my days trying to figure out ways to make it up to them. And I'm a reasonably creative person and clever person, and I don't like to leave people wronged in my past.
And to be fair, historically, there were a lot of issues of misunderstanding around the Spanish Inquisition as well. So, you know, humanity has a bit of a history of it in this. Tosin, would you like to put those last two questions to Jonathan, please?
Have you had an amazing Zoomer with us today?
Yes. Has it been good for you? Have you enjoyed the Zoomer, Jonathan?
Yeah, absolutely. No, this has been a wonderful interaction, and also like each person has a different dynamic as they. I was like, how bad are they going to grill me? This has been fabulous. This is fun.
Hey, listen, I mean, you know, Anna and Amanda, they can go in all sorts of ways, basically. But you know, it's all good. So will you be kind enough to join us again? Will you come back sometime and keep us appraised of your fantasy writing, and maybe just occasionally some spider information as well?
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm happy to be an evil spider biologist on your program whenever you want one.
Do you know, let's face it. I mean, that is a gap in the University
Wouldn't
of Lincoln.
Be a show without one, would
exactly.
It?
We need that evil spider genius.
Yeah, we do.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
I admit I was very tempted to actually feature Michael Giacchino's Spider-Man Homecoming Suite, but I thought, no, it'd be too crass. Let's just have The Cure. Anyway, thank you to Jonathan Pruitt, our evil spider genius, self-titled, and academic, who was great, but is great in a different way now. Let's move back to the program. In the studio, we have, of course, Tosin Shojemi from, of course, Nigeria, but here doing all sorts of great things, etc. Have you wrapped up your master's degree completely now, or is it a case of you just chilling and doing Afrobeats on Siren Radio every Sunday between 7 and 9?
It's a case of chilling on the Afrobeats show every Sunday 7 to 9.
It's important. Of course, you know, at the other end of our studies, just starting her postgraduate work, it's Anna Coscanell, who, you know, no reading week, Anna, presumably. Or do you get reading week?
No, now I'm good. I'll get one in a couple of weeks.
A couple of weeks, yeah. That's very good. It's business, obviously. You need to work our way through that. But of regular fixture now on the Midweek Drive Live. And who knows, Amanda Jones, of course, just her second show, and she's been so stressed, it's unbelievable. Normally she comes with a whole stack of information. And normally musicians have been known to quake, literally quake, before the grilling of Amanda Jones. I mean, Victoria Simmons said, I'll come on the show again, but, you know, don't let Amanda ask any questions. It's a sigh of relief when she knew what we went on last week's show. Then, of course, Anna turned up. Oh, disaster. And Darren Scales, of course, our cinematic filmmaker. Darren, before we introduce the ace musician who's with us in a few moments, would you like to explain a bit more about that dark universe fantasy world?
Oh, yes. So I created the Dark Wave universe. So it's set in our future 100 years from now when humanity has won and lost the ability to travel faster than the speed of light. So mankind, men, women, children all across the galaxy, all stranded. And then something happens, and it's basically like Knight Rider in space.
Quite literally, you go back to square one.
Yes.
See what I did there, Sophie? Go back to square one. Welcome, Sophie Kay, from Sophie and the Sticks. How are you? She's gone very quiet. Has she muted herself? Has she gone, vanished? Has she given up
in
all sorts of ways?
She's amazed with my story, that's what it was.
I would have thought so.
She can't follow it.
Oh, well. Let's move on to Square One, which actually is a reveal for Siren Radio. It's an exclusive. It is actually the first release of Sophie and the Sticks. It is Square One. Sophie, have you... I'll tell you what, it might help if I open up her channel. I mean, you know, honestly, the incompetence that you actually have here. Sorry, Sophie, you're probably sort of yelling at the whole thing. I said, what's going on? Sophie, would you like to start over again, back to Square One?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So would you like to introduce Sophie and the Sticks with Square One, and are you ready to be grilled by Tosin, by Anna, and by Darren, Daz, and of course by Amanda?
I think so. Ready as I'll ever be.
If you can cope with Hannah O'Brien, you'll be fine. And Hannah's joining us in the next hour as well, so you're more welcome to stick around. Anyway, what are we about to hear? Is it literally a case of going back to square one? Is it something which is designed for geometricians, mathematicians, and so on? Are we talking about existential calculus here? Tell us about it, Sophie.
Oh, yeah, all of the above. No, it's about moving back basically to your mum's house and realising, you know, you've kind of looped back around and you're back at square one. And it was actually just before the pandemic that I wrote it, not knowing what was coming and that I was really going to be back to square one for a while. That's the gist of it.
Here it comes. 3 minutes, 47 seconds of audio bliss.
TV on. I just about manage if the door's open. Even as a child, I sleep in dark rooms in silence. And I'm supposed to be a grown woman. I don't know. Keep on pretending like I'm fooling anyone. Zuckerberg square one again, cause I'm sleeping in my childhood home, but I don't mind at all. I'm still not done.
Was it really 5 years ago you wrote your first song, Sophie? I thought it was at least 48.
Yeah, probably a bit longer now.
Yeah. Reminds me of the first song I wrote 5 years ago and still going, rightly so. Okay, let's do a quick round the studio lineup. Darren, Daz, what did you make of Back to Square One?
Well, yeah, very, very nice. Good foot tapper, which I like. It makes me
key change as well. Very impressive.
I did
key
notice
change.
That. Yeah, yeah. And I was listening to the arrangement as well, and especially at the end as well, how it was sort of like getting more quiet and more poignant at the end. With the same words, but meant something slightly different, which I did enjoy. So, 10 out of 10 for me.
Good stuff. Okay, Amanda Jones.
Oh, I really liked it. I was, you know, rocking my head, and I've already got some questions I'd like to ask.
Actually. I thought you might. You know, let's do the sort of red. Anna, your thoughts on Back to Square One?
I like the song, and I like the lyrics and the meaning of the whole song. Oh. It reminds me of, I don't know, somewhat part of high school where I didn't know where I was heading, and I felt I was just going back in circles.
Yeah. A little life secret: most of us don't know where we're heading. Just saying.
Encouraging.
Great wisdom, Alex. Great wisdom.
It's just the whole thing. And Tosin, from yourself.
It's a great song. I love that it's relatable because 2020 was the year like a lot of people didn't know what was going to happen. And everybody was going back to somewhere they knew before that was kind of familiar. So it brings that kind of familiarity from 2020. And it's just a great song to listen to, honestly. It's a really good song.
Thumbs up, Sophie. So there we are. Marvellous stuff. Square One. Success. Anna, or rather, Amanda, questions, please.
The feeling of nostalgia struck me in that song. So I was wondering, how different does that emotion feel between holding that feeling and sitting in your room versus writing that feeling out and producing a song for it? And how does that then sort of change when you think about nostalgia, when you think about home, how that sort of perhaps affect your memory of it, of home?
Yeah, absolutely. That was I'd been away from home for a couple of years traveling before, and then come back to my mum's and writing that, and now excuse me, looking back on it now that I'm no longer living at my mum's place, which is great. No offense, Mum. Love living with you.
I'm pleased you said that. I mean, obviously this is important. I mean, parents are very difficult to bring into the world, so you know.
Yeah. And it's the feeling of maybe sometimes being a bit resentful of it, like, you know, wanting to keep moving forward, and you're like, oh God, I'm here again. But also the flip side of it where you're like, oh, okay, I'm here again. Let me see what's changed, or, you know, it's kind of nice to see familiar faces and to feel in, to have familiar surroundings sometimes if you're, depending on what stage you're at in life, right? So yeah, sometimes you get a bit homesick and you want to come back to square one, and then sometimes you want to run away, and definitely in my music there's a sort of flipping between that constantly, a sort of wanting to belong somewhere but at the same time wanting to always be free and keep moving. So, and yeah, nostalgia kind of dips in and out of that all the time.
I
hope that answers your
question. That really does. I also just want to add on along as well with the lyrics of the repetition of 5 years, your first song, and I thought that's pretty much that, you know, that pretty much sums up how we measure time. So it was my birthday not too long ago, and it didn't really struck me as anything special, because I think it becomes such a monotonous routine that nothing really strikes you until I had a phone call from someone we've been friends for 7 years now, and realizing that felt a lot more like, damn, I have now turned this age, rather than someone just giving me cards and cakes. And it just sort of reminds me of your song, how we, you know, personally we measure time through relationships.
75 is a milestone, as you said, Amanda. So you're doing very well for that. Looking good. Tosin,
I have a question. The name Sophie and the Sticks is such a cool name and so unique. Like, how did you come up with that? Because I just want to hear a story behind it, because it sounds like a cool story, to be honest.
Well, thanks for thinking it's cool. It just rolled off the tongue one day. The Styx is my drummer, Aaliyah, so I was hoping to have them here with me today, but they both ended up caught up in other parts of town, and they're just on the way back, so I think they'll just miss it, unfortunately, but they're here in spirit. And
Sophie, I sent you all the links for parts 3 and 4, so you feel free to join in on the next stages as well. You know, we trust you. You're part of the team, so there we are.
Thank you. So she's the Styx. She just after drumsticks. She carries around a big bag of drumsticks with her everywhere, and I just started calling her the Styx. And yeah, Sophie and the Styx. And then we've got John, the bassist, as well. And we weren't quite sold.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's such a cool name.
Yeah. It all works splendid well. SophieOfTheStyxOfCourse.com is the website to go through. Darren, any questions for yourself?
Yeah, just thinking about the sort of the songwriting process overall. I mean, I've not experienced the Styx phenomenon until today, but always curious in terms of when you come up with an idea for a song, is it lyrics first, melody second? Do you have like a stock of melodies and tunes that you sort of play with, or lyrics at the same? How does it come together? What's the catalyst, do you think, for you and your band?
Yeah, honestly, it can be any of the above. Sometimes a melody will pop in and I'll sit down with that at the piano and sort of build some music around that, and then go back and listen. I'll do a sort of voice memo on my phone of that, and then you go back and tend to kind of just say random words, and you can it's a bit like connecting the dots. You kind of figure out what the song is about after you've done the lyrics and the melody. And then other times it will be, you know, a phrase that comes into my head, or I see something and I think, oh, that'll make a great lyric. And then you can sit down just with the lyrics without any music or any ideas for melody and sort of work on that as kind of like a poem. And then later I'll be playing. Sometimes I just sit at the piano then and I'll find some nice chords or like nice chord progression. And then I'll be like, oh, let me see if I can, you know, fit some of these lyrics that I've written previously to this chord progression, and then build a melody over that with the lyrics.
So do you get do you have I don't say a little black book, but do you have like on your phone or something, like a notepad or something, wherever you think of stuff or think of ideas or think of like some
Sophie's
lyrics,
sleeves of paper.
Yeah, you just oh, I've got to write this down. I've got it before I forget it or something like that.
Absolutely. I've got a notebook by my bed. I carry a notebook with me. I've got about 12. Well, yeah, there's a lot.
None of this nonsense high technology, put things down on digital scenarios. That's a notebook with a pen.
Well, it should be. I'm just trying to be cool. That was all.
At the moment, I've got 1,500 voice memos on my phone. So,
that's a lot.
Yeah.
Is that because you collect them or something? Or do you like sort of you have fondness? It's like a sort of, you know, some people like to collect coins, stamps. You collect voicemails.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Good. Very bad for the phone memory, but no, it's good when you don't have any Wi-Fi and you want to dip back into some old ideas. It's great.
Amanda.
I'm curious, actually, is there a difference to how it influences your creativity when you record these via voice notes over a simple pen and paper?
Yeah, I guess it definitely stimulates different areas of creativity. I think when I'm sat at the piano and just sort of freestyling like that, that's probably what I enjoy the most, and sort of feels most creative. You can just sort of let your hands go wherever they want, and it's, sometimes writing the lyrics can be the most frustrating part because you want to find the exact right words, and you know, you're kind of always doubting, and could I use something else here, is the rhythm right? And there's a lot more questions than when you're just kind of sitting down and
always more questions than answers.
Yes
Tosin.
Sophie, so I checked your website and I saw like you've done a lot of live shows, and I really wanted to ask a question. What's the difference within the way you sing for a live show and the way you record? Because I know like live is always kind of different, and the way you sing, the way you change the key, but for you, like, what do you think the biggest difference is, and how do you enjoy the live shows, basically?
Yeah, we love playing live. Something that we kind of pride ourselves on, but also laugh about, is that we do improvise a lot. You know, I don't think we have probably ever played the song the same twice exactly, so that's fun, but also very frustrating when you come to record, because you really have to decide, okay, do I...
Discipline, Sophie, that's what you need. Discipline.
Yes, that is not the first time I've heard that. Thank you.
Royal Schools of Music Training, you see, back in the day. I had to learn those arpeggios and such like, very vital. Let's move on to music. We talked about live. Toasted mentioned live stuff there. How would you feel about us playing the live version of Circles, Sophie? I mean, we featured this on your debut of the production. Do you think it's the kind of thing which could lead into 2 minutes of Darren Scales talking and explaining how important the Dark Wave universe might be to the uninitiated?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, then. Here are Sophie and the Styx and Circles live.
early 90s and creator of the Darkwave universe, an exciting science fiction franchise that's 10 years in the making, and it's something that I'd like to share with you. Darkwave is a fully developed, exciting science fiction family franchise, starting with an 8-part season, scripts ready and good to go. Set in our future, where humankind has enjoyed a century of fast and light travel, this is an easy-to-follow, share-and-enjoy adventure that will not hurt your head. Darkwave is a product of my life experience. Growing up in the 80s, I was a child of simple toys and stories. Shows such as Battle of the Planets, Knight Rider, Battlestar Galactica fueled my imagination. I was mesmerized with super technology, space, and awesome machines. Darkwave is a product of my life. In the RAF, as a filmmaker, but more importantly, my lifelong love of pulse-racing sci-fi. Darkwave enjoys an ensemble cast, but leading the way are three inclusive protagonists. Jason, a cheeky 20-something, boyish but brave. Star, a wondrous, mysterious young woman. And then there's the Phoenix, a super sentient starfighter, like Airwolf and Knight Rider in space. This is a coming-of-age story, which sets a difference between good and evil, heroes and villains, giving everyone on the sofa someone to root for. Eager to see the Darkwave universe on the big screen, I chose one small part of it and made The Drift, a 100-minute feature-length movie made for just £5,000 and accruing over 3 million views. But I wanted to see the Phoenix, this awesome machine flying on the big screen. So a few years later, I made another film, Edge of the Storm. Now we have a fan base with thousands of subscribers and over 5 million views. The future of Darkwave now rests with the acquisition of financial investment, with the aim to develop it into a full commercial franchise. So much has been done already. Darkwave is not just a concept. It's got artwork, developed characters, 8 scripts, story arcs for another 4 seasons, a production bible, a concept short, a feature movie, a social following, a media following, a celebrity following, an EPK, a documentary, news articles, numerous reviews. It's brand new UK sci-fi, and it's ready to go now.
I really feel as though I should stand up and salute with respect to that one, Darren, and probably will do. One slight lacunae, slight gap there. Needs music from Sophie and the Sticks, that's all I'm saying. Sophie, there you have it. Okay, the end of your first quarter of the programme, the first package. Are you still there, by the way?
I am, yeah. Hey. I just realised, I don't know if... just for you guys, I don't know if you can see me now.
We can.
No? We can. You're kind of in witness protection program, but that's okay. You know, that's all right. You know, it's radio. We just thought you were being naturally shy and said, you know, or in a very dark room. It's okay, Sophie. Honestly, you're fine. You're a musician. You have these eccentricities. That's the important thing. As I said, I won't say the last two. Well, first of all, have you had a reasonably interesting first Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been good for you?
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Are you going to come back again in literally about 20 seconds from now when you move into Zoomer number 3?
Okay. Yeah,
this is it, because then Victoria Simmons can meet you, can meet Jean Bruce Scott. By the way, I'll probably say the word Airwolf at least once when we're speaking to Jean Bruce Scott. You might like to use Google or something to actually just find out exactly what Airwolf was all about. I'm just saying, Sophie, you know, in terms of that. I'm sorry, Darren, but, you know, you had somebody in the studio who I knew... didn't understand when you said Knight Rider. I mean, these things are lost in time. You know? Like, you know, spider professors who kind of get lost as well.
Evil
spiders. Sophie Kay will return. We'll be speaking to Jessica Purdy from Prickly Pear. We've got Hannah O'Brien, the person responsible for Sophie being on the programme as well. Randy Reinholtz, of course, and Jean Bruce Scott. And maybe even some Phil Leonis too, here on the Midweek Drive, live. Shadows approaching me. When we're old and wise, or experientially enhanced and chronologically gifted, makes you think of being a Native American in a Martin Scorsese movie. Maybe not. Randy Reinholtz from, of course, Native Voices, and indeed an ace professor in your own right who's never falsified his work. No, quite rightly so. Not a shocking spider person, or as you rightly said, Darren, evil spider genius. Randy, welcome back to the Midweek Drive Live. How are you?
Oh, Alex, I love your introductions. That was wonderful.
Wow.
Falsified work. That was perfect. That is the hot topic in America.
Well, you know, I mean, you did raise this whole sort of question, so we thought we'd follow it through. In the studio, Randy, we have got the awesome Darren Scales, of course, huge, huge fan of all matters Airwolf and more. And, of course, you know, is Jean going to be with us, or is she deciding, no, not today?
I think Jean's going to be with you. I'm going to speak loudly off mic and just make sure she's in the other room set up.
It's okay. So, I mean, you know,
she's landing the lady.
It's so true, yeah. Exactly. Again, a reference which, if you're not familiar with Airwolf, you won't know. Sophie Kay back with us, of course, because we felt, yeah, Sophie, you're still in witness protection, but we don't mind. You know, we know what you look like, and that's fine. It's all good. Wondrous sort of individual. How are you, Sophie?
I'm grand, thank you. I am going to have to run off shortly, though, okay. But I just wanted to say thank you so much, and also another hello to Hannah, if she can hear me at
well,
all.
Well, yeah. Hannah's quite literally just above you in the kind of the Zoom house at present. She's in the square window just above you, and she's been waving, literally waving to you on that moment. So welcome, Hannah, and you're, of course, being taken out by your mother to actually see a theatrical performance, I believe, this evening.
I am indeed off to see Sister Act tonight, but lovely to catch up with you, Sophie. I know it was in passing that we saw each other before, so good to see that you made it.
If it wasn't for Hannah O'Brien, Sophie's case career would have taken a completely different path, and she wouldn't have had to endure the questioning of both Anna and Amanda on the Midweek Drive. But that's okay. And Tosin and Darren as well, of course, clearly. Anyway, thanks for that. And we presumably, Sophie, we'll see you again in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you all so much.
Absolutely.
Catch you soon.
If people are wondering what's happened to our prickly pear person, Jessica Purdy, I don't know either. She said, is it on for tonight? Yes, I said. Here's the link. So we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, she is in Lincoln, so getting a Zoom link to actually work in the studio from Lincoln can be very problematic. As we know, it's a lot easier to go to San Diego. So Randy, very briefly, Martin Scorsese's latest movie, I alluded to it there in passing. Have you seen it as yet? I presume you know many of the cast, basically, because it is obviously something that already seems to be highly tipped for the Academy Awards in 2024.
Yeah, it was supposed to be released a year or maybe 18 months ago. It came out through Apple, and we were sort of all excited waiting for it. And then they delayed the release so it could premiere at Cannes. And it wasn't an official entry, but it had, I think, a 7 or 9 minute standing ovation. So it was very warmly received, unusual for that film festival. And then, I do know behind me is old Lily, who is the front runner to be nominated for an Academy Award.
When you say old Lily, I mean, for goodness sakes, you're referring to one of the key stars of the whole production there, basically. She probably learned it all from Jean Bruce Scott, that's what I would say. Jean, welcome to the program.
She did.
How are you, and what's it like being in the next room to Randy at present?
It's great. He's been gone for 7 weeks directing in Arizona, so I'm happy to have him home.
Good. Excellent. And this is trying, obviously, keep one room to each other. And finally, we managed to welcome another newbie to the program. She's the founder of Prickly Pear. That's quite literally pricklypear.co.uk. Jessica Purdy. How are you, Jessica?
Hi, everyone. Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
Excellent.
This is my second radio of the day, actually.
Well, you see, once you start, it's carrying on. Jean, I appreciate in San Diego, you may have actually got a completely different view of prickly pears. You might say, surely that's a cactus or something completely different. Would you like to find out a bit about what the prickly pear founder has in mind when she talks about prickly pear material?
Very much so. I want to know what that is.
Yeah. So, Jessica, tell us, what's it all about?
Yeah, so I founded Prickly Pear 2 years ago. And we make handmade clothing and alterations. And that's how we started. I was in the fashion industry for 4 years and I realised that there was something missing. And that was community and inclusiveness within fashion. And so I wanted to create a brand that had community at the forefront. So then when we'd got a little bit, we then started to aim at communities and provide creative workshops to upskill people and also bring people together, because one of my passions is the old PR in me is bringing people together and making them friends. So we are a little bit more than just clothing, and I feel very, very passionate about working on projects that are involved with community and social issues.
That sounds fascinating. Do you have any pictures or samples of your work you could describe to us?
I was just making a sleeve a minute ago. We mainly work on lots of wedding dresses in the shop, that we still continue our alterations and clothing commission service. We've done some costumes for bands. But the creative workshop side of things, we are partnered with multiple charities in Lincolnshire, and that's where we're based. The NHS, we've provided some workshops for them, more mental health side of things, and charities such as, well, we've got one tomorrow with Shine Lincolnshire, who are a mental health charity, and we're doing pom-poms. And it's just a little excuse to get people together, to have a little chat, and we break the ice, really.
Wonderful. What an incredible job you're doing, but also what fun. I wish I was in the neighborhood.
Hey, Jean, we're on the same planet.
Yeah, we're on the same planet.
Exactly. You just haven't.
Our shop you could probably see from space because it's bright pink.
Indeed, Amanda, I believe you've been in the Prickly Pear store. Is that not the case? And you might once have done an interview with Jessica. She did remember you, I'm sure. Anyway, what are your thoughts on Prickly Pear?
Oh, I do remember interviewing you. feels like, I think it was, was it 2 years ago
now? Oh, years ago then, literally.
Years ago. Yes. And I'm so happy to hear that it's still there and it seems like you're growing, you're expanding. So that's, it's really exciting to like see you again, but this time on a radio platform.
So often, Jessica, Amanda does an interview and the business collapses completely. So it was obviously trepidation. He's still going. So that's the important thing. It's good to know. That's important.
At least we're doing something right.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk Airwolf again. And, of course, over to yourself, Darren. I mean, Darren, I have been working quite diligently over the last few years to ensure that the University of Lincoln CSETs and avoids awards visiting professorships to both Randy and to Jean Bruce Scott. I thought we were getting there, but then they had a complete change in realignment. You know what we went through, you know, we're still going through, etc.
That campaign
has not ended.
Well, no, we will not give up.
We will certainly not give up. But any questions you've got for either Randy or indeed Jean Bruce Scott? And I wonder, has Jean seen the Airwolf reference? I mean, surely this needs to be...
Well, Jean and I spoke the last time, I think it was pre-pandemic, and then obviously, you know, all that got in the way. But we did have a brief chat about a few things. And I've definitely been taking influences from Airwolf. In fact, our... in the Dark Wave universe, they fly the Phoenix, which is a bit like Airwolf, I suppose. But they have as a male and female, and it used to be when I first wrote the story, it was just a pilot, Jason. But then, you know, going back to my Airwolf and thinking about Caitlin and what was going on there, we have a male and female all inclusive team working together, which is what happened in Airwolf. It started with Stringfellow Hawk and Dominic Santini, and then obviously Kenan's character came in and got to fly the helicopter, which I'm very jealous about. I think if you ask me, have any questions for Jean, there'd be so many. I'd take up the rest of your show, to be honest, because there's just so much about Airwolf that I would talk about.
Serve it as an educational part of you, because if I do a random selection, Tosin in Nigeria, Airwolf, yes. did it cross the boundaries?
Probably did, but it didn't reach me.
It didn't reach yourself. It didn't reach me. Romania, Airwolf?
I think same for Romania.
Same for Romania. These are territories that need to be exploited, Gene, and get to back in touch with the Belisarius company and Universal. They, you know, no Nigeria, no Romania. Anna, obviously, or Amanda, I should say, in terms of Airwolf, again, you weren't even sure what Knight Rider was, so presumably Airwolf is...
But it's a stealth helicopter. It's stealth, don't forget. It flies below the radar. It's Mark 1 plus attack. You know, they're not going to see it. They're not going to see that. That's the thing. Only if you watched it at 20 past one on a Saturday morning in 1985 would you actually see it. That was the only time. So I'm not surprised. No. And you're missing out. You are made, like, you know, CGI barely existed in the 80s. That helicopter was flying for real. Oh. And the attention to detail was amazing. The shutter speed to make the rotors look a certain way, the way it sounded, it was absolutely amazing. You need to look it up. And just the trio that used to fly it, you know, String, Dom, and Caitlin flying the Airwolf is amazing. You've got to see it.
We'd love to check it out right now. After the show, that's what I'll do. First
change thing. Your life.
Yeah, forget the visit to the gym. Go watch some Airwolf. Yeah. It'd be very good for the spirit. Hannah O'Brien, Airwolf and such like?
I think that way back when I was at Lincoln,
yes,
at uni, I think we did, yes. We have met before, yes. Jean, and we yes. have discussed Airwolf
yes.
before, but I still haven't watched it. My so God. I do need to...
You were so on
and yes. actually stream it.
And you're one of my best graduate students, Hannah. I mean, for goodness sakes, you know, it's no hope, is there really? You know, it's sometimes.
I have a quick fix for all of this. So I know that Facebook is not anything that any of you are on, but my page is public and it's called the Jean Bruce Scott Archive on Facebook.
Every Friday. Special archive. Posts going up there, you know, put together.
And yes, and there are posts and little clips of what I did on the show, so you could get a taste of it. And then I do actually have fans from Nigeria and from Romania and from all around the world that talk to me on this horrible Facebook thing that I'm on. But we're trying to move into Instagram, and if you can tell me what the next thing is, maybe I can try to get onto that so that some of the younger audience can come and see the show, because it is quite a lot of fun. And the helicopter is spectacular.
Yeah. For next platform, you can try TikTok. Yeah. TikTok, exactly.
Go to TikTok. Yeah. Okay, I'll have to research that.
Good for the Chinese market, Jean, if nothing else, but that's a data protection issue. Okay, we've identified the key. Jessica Purdy, I haven't asked you, of course, were you an Airwolf or Knight Rider fan or indeed Magnum PI, perhaps?
Not a clue.
Not a clue, yeah, exactly. Too busy making her crap, making the world a better place from her pink store of prickly pear. It's just important.
I just don't have much spare time.
You should multitask. Anyway, back to yourself, Darren. Any thoughts, observations, and such like stuff?
Well, just thinking about the prickly pear thing, and just what, in terms of what I do in my filmmaking, I'm a community filmmaker as well as a lecturer, and I just think it's really nice to hear of other businesses, other areas that are getting involved, and sharing their talent and their time, and just those things that you're doing in the next couple of days. I just find it really heartwarming to hear about work on people's mental health. It's such a big deal, and it has such a, some people sort of sigh, but for me it's like we all have a mental health, we all have a state of mental health, and if some people can communicate more easily by making products and creativity, whether it's in filmmaking or in fabric, either way, I think it's just really good to hear. So I'm really glad to have heard about Prickly Pear today. I just think it's well done, and thanks for sharing it.
For those folks,
no, thank you. I think if we have personalities that can break a room, like break the ice, put ourselves out there a little bit, it makes other people who might be introverted a little bit more comfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
Building confidence is one thing that we do in this place as a whole, whether that be build somebody's confidence by making them look fabulous or build their confidence through workshops or social groups.
Just making the world a better place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Much as Don Belisarius did with Airwolf, but still, never mind. Lily Gladstone, of course, we want to talk briefly about her. I mean, as the movie was developing, Randy, particularly fascinated by that, have you seen it as yet? Have you seen the thing? Is it as good as people have said? Because I haven't seen it as yet, but I know a number of our colleagues have, and they would say this is outstanding.
Just coming out, and it is a fantastic film. I'm going to tell a story on Jeannie, and then Jeannie can tell you about the film. Jeannie came home from Montana 10 years ago. We were producing a show up there, and she said, oh my God, I've met a star. She's a student at the University of Montana, and she's fantastic. And we cast her in one of our plays that we were co-producing up there. And then she played the lead here at Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and that's Lily Gladstone. Mm. So even as a young person, she had that thing. And she is, while she's remarkably beautiful, I've said that she's more like the Native American Mona Lisa than anything, because she's so enigmatic. When you look at her, you're not sure what's going on, and it's so interesting to look at her. Jean, you're up.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an actress with so much poise and so much going on. And as Randy says, when she was a student, she starred in one of our shows called The Fry Bread Queen, along with Aragon Starr and Jane Lind, who was a Native American actress legend. And Lily just was so present in every moment that you couldn't not watch what she was doing to see what was happening on stage. And she wasn't drawing attention. She was just in the moment. And if you go and see Killers of the Flower Moon, you will see that happening on the screen. She is, as Randy said, enigmatic. You can't not watch her to see what's happening and what she's thinking about. The film itself is so much fun. It's a combination of, I think, everything Martin Scorsese has ever wanted to try his hand at. And so there are so many different genres and ideas in it that at first it's a little startling. And then as you get into the story and he's telling the story, of course you're carried away by that. But then after the film, you find yourself going back to certain parts and saying, was that Martin Scorsese in the film? Was that a radio show? Was that a film? Was that, and so
the radio show is a key part to the whole aspect, certainly. And I heard recently, Gene, it's actually pronounced Scorsese. according to the whole thing. I mean, and many critics over the years have actually been incorrectly pronouncing Martin's surname. It's Scorsese, as opposed to Scorsese. Yeah, I know. I'm just saying that
Scorsese?
Was revealed Scorsese. By Miss Schumacher, his film editor, that it's actually Scorsese, not Scorsese.
I will correct my pronunciation. Thank you,
Alex. Yeah, it's just one of those sort of areas. People have said it's a bit long at 3.5 hours. I don't think it could be too long from that point of view. I think it just unfolds naturally and tells a story, as you say, in the greatest way forward. So not bad, I think, for an octogenarian filmmaker. Actually, two octogenarians, because Robert De Niro is also 80. You have both of them sort of performing on that side of things.
De Niro is fantastic in this. You don't know which way to think about him, and then when you find out the way you're going to think about him, you're going to be very surprised.
Yeah.
He's wonderful. They had a lot of help with the Osage Nation, the tribal nation, came in and helped them quite a bit with what was going on there. There are actual photographs from the time that if you look at those and then you look at photographs from the film, they look the same. So he's done a marvelous job of depicting what was happening there and what a sensation it was. And then, of course, what a tragedy it ended up being with the discovery of oil.
Again, that black gold that hits all manner of challenges and such like, not good for the planet, and who would have thought? But then again, they said the same about the cigarette industry, and let's face it, Edward Bernays did an awful lot of positive PR for that before people realised, actually, it's not good for your health, after all, not good at all. Okay, Randy, in terms of your play production, I mean, you seem to be never consistently always producing material, etc. What else is coming up as we approach Thanksgiving?
I actually have a new, I just directed the Thanksgiving play, which is a very popular play here in the United States. We have this habit of getting young children to perform, you know, skits or plays like they do anywhere.
And presidents who pardon turkeys as well, as opposed to turkeys pardoning presidents. It's very important.
I think it's 48 million turkeys are killed each year for Thanksgiving. So there are many gruesome facts about Thanksgiving that we kind of gloss over.
That's a lot of gobbling.
Teach children about these stories. And so this play pokes fun at teachers teaching misinformation and then trying to do the socially correct thing. And it's so ridiculous. So that was a lot of fun. And it's become one of the most produced plays in the United States, Larissa Fasthorse. And she's just about to debut a new adaptation of Peter Pan, which treats the indigenous folks in the story much different than the original story did, as you might imagine. So they're hoping to revive that, and then it's got a big national tour and then go on to Broadway.
Another actress that we discovered long ago when she was about 12 years old, Zaragoza, is Tiger Lily.
And this, Gene, is why your founding of the Native American Voices at the Autry, you know, it led to so much profoundness that, you know, we appreciate it even now. I noticed, Hannah, that your co-star actually decided to wander across the screen there, a feline friend. Would you like to just provide a little name check for who we actually saw, at least in the studio? Some of us might have caught that. But somebody actually said, I want to see what the Prickly Pear is all about.
Ray, the kitten, has made an appearance. She's in the bad books at the moment. We had a gardening incident last week,
dear.
And she's decided that she wants to eat all the plants that really aren't very good for her.
Right. So that's much a little ray of sunshine, more kind of little ray of possible diarrhea. Never mind.
It's an ironic ray of sunshine.
It's deeply ironic in so many ways. Jessica, very briefly, Prickly Pear, is it easier to go to pricklypear.co.uk if people want to find out more, if they're even abroad, if they're even in San Diego and they're thinking, yeah, let's find out more about pricklypear.co.uk, can you be located via that base in cyberspace?
Yeah, you can go there, or we've got all the social medias. So Instagram is the most prominent.
Let's try and cross-connect you here. I mean, from your experience with respect to all the social medias, the universal impact there, to Gene just basically sort of doing Facebook and doing it very well, of course, thanks to, of course, Jackie, who is a key helper and assistant and puts all things through with respect to that, Jackie Rennick and company. So what advice would you give Gene to actually, you know, work that? Should she go TikTok? Should she go Instagram? Should she go Threads? You know, should she actually sort of say, what the hey, I'll do X?
Well, it depends on what target audience you want to hit, really. If you want to hit that younger crowd, TikTok and Instagram's probably where it's at.
And X, no more?
Predominantly, three times today, a client or customers come in saying, I found you via Instagram. And that's three people that walked through the door just today. So we think that's quite a high percentage of our clients that find us, or companies that find us, are through Instagram. So
Instagram.
All our content that goes on to Instagram shares across Facebook as well. So you can have two purposes for one bit of content.
Yeah.
What was the name of the other one? Cause Space?
Facebook?
No, not Facebook.
You said, you're double posting and Instagram.
Oh, content. The actual piece. That we're posting, the content goes across two places, so you can reuse
much as indeed these Midweek Drive live shows do a couple of hours after they've been broadcast. They go on a number of things. It used to be simultaneously, but Podbean decided, no, we've had enough with Elon Musk. If you wanted to do Elon Musk and X, you have to put it on yourself. Same with respect to Facebook. It's very confusing. Anna, you've also found this challenge in terms of social media because you haven't reached your 5 million followers as yet. Never mind, it's always a target. Any thoughts or questions you'd like to put to the team, either in Gloucestershire, in San Diego, or High Street of Lincoln?
I actually have lots of questions, so I'm a bit confused on who should I ask and what should I do. I'm going to ask Jessica. Firstly, I want to tell her that I had a look at her website, and I really like that it's pink and it's cozy and nice. And I wanted to ask her, she said on her website, and she told us that this is kind of art, doing clothes is kind of art and expressing themselves. When people are doing their art, or crafting, you said that you have a story for each person. What was the most emotional story that someone has shared with you while doing this?
Without names, obviously, but you know, there
yes.
we are.
I've had some quite personal things, obviously, with client confidentiality, I probably wouldn't share. But once I was doing a creative workshop for a group of kids, and one of the kids, while he was trying to sew, kept giving up and said, I can't do it. And I said, well, you haven't tried. And he said, well, I know I can't do it. And I was like, well, you need to try. Come on. You can't do anything without trying. And I'm a strong believer in just winging it until you know how to do it. So it's just the way I teach people. And I just said, come on, you need to give it a go because you'll never know. And you don't want to go home and not be able to say that you haven't tried. Anyway, then he did start to cry, and I said, well, what's wrong? And he was like, I can't do it because all I see is smoke. And I said, oh, no, what do you mean all you see is smoke? And he said, well, when I was on holiday, I was caught in a hotel fire a couple of years ago, and since then I can never do anything because all I can see is smoke when I'm trying to concentrate. And he opened up to me, and as you know, a safeguarding adult, I had to pass this straight on to his teacher, who knew nothing about this, and he'd never opened up to any teachers to let them know this is why he struggles with school. So you know, from a really small task like hand sewing, he's been able to open himself up, expose himself a little bit, and you know, now his teachers are going to be a lot better off trying to teach him and know what's going on. And that's just from one craft, and it's all because of there was no need for eye contact when we were talking, because we were talking and trying to sew. So I'm no mental health expert at all, but I have the gift of the gab. I can tap. And I think sometimes people just need an ear. So
this is really touching. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Yeah, well, okay. Quick time for yourself, and Amanda, off you go.
Hi, Jess. I think last time that we talked, I was trying to interview you for an article about
thrifting, and it was largely sort of aimed at our younger readers. And I wonder if, you know, we were talking about social media, knowing your target audience, but yes, there's target audience, and there's also sort of people who are able to have the level of income to be able to buy sort of more sustainable materials, that because it doesn't sort of cut corners, because it's a lot more transparent on how much a product actually costs, that sort of being able to, I wonder on the consumer side, because I sometimes go through your website and I love your design, but sometimes for a student who's on a shoestring budget, how do you maybe reconcile, I don't know, that sort of gap perhaps? But
wow, that's, I mean, obviously we can go into the financial mechanics of the whole thing, but Jessica, she's bowled a little curly there. Off you go.
Well, as long as, you know, me and the team, we obviously work in UK wages, so everything is set by hour, and that's how we work our prices out. But I do see some gaps, like you said, with students, and we've all been there when we've been students and we've eaten baked beans for weeks. You can't really afford to be splashing out and buying things, but there's a thing called a product ladder in a business, and that's making sure that you can see your client through to the very end. So you might come to me first with not a lot of money, but still want to buy into the brand, and that's where we offer our social group, which is called Stitch and Bitch. Eventually it will be free. At the minute it's out of my own pocket and it's £5, but we are working at the moment with some bodies high up in the Lincolnshire area at the minute, and I'm trying my best.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen, Jessica. All right.
Don't
say anything else, but, you know, it's fine. Jessica, have you enjoyed your time on the Midweek Drive Live?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Yeah.
Good. I mean, you're welcome to come into the studio. I mean, we're not that far away. Probably we're up 2 miles, but never mind.
I didn't have wedding deadlines.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Of course. Hannah O'Brien, has it been good for you? She's muted herself.
It has been lovely for me, thank you. I'm just wrestling with this one.
Look, you know, I mean, clearly Ray is desperately keen to make her particular role. She's a rescue cat. You know, she says, I want to eat those seeds that make me ill. You know, it's her decision and choice. You know, what
the? I think, Alex, the thing that I'm actually trying to stop her is stepping on the power button of the laptop.
She might have had enough.
That's her favourite trick at the moment, just switching off the laptop.
Enough already. You know, animals know. They know we spend far too much time on screen. It's not healthy for us. Anyway, Jean Bruce Scott, has it been good for you?
Oh, absolutely. It's always great to see all of you again. And Jessica, I went to your website as well where we were talking, and what brilliant work you're doing. And I love the front of your shop. Oh my gosh. I think driving down the street and seeing that would make me so happy. It's really lovely. Wonderful work that you're doing.
No, thank you. The aim was just to attract people and bring them in, and we've captured some fantastic souls.
So when the time comes for Jean Bruce Scott and Randy Reinholtz to return to Lincoln, it's got to happen one of these days, clearly Prickly Pear might be on your itinerary. Randy, has it been okay for your good self in the last half hour or so?
Love it. Love learning about Prickly Pear. Love the guests on here. Hannah, it's nice to see you again. Thanks, Alex.
Well, I mean, I just wave a pen somewhere and you sort of see me there in the background. Say, look there, that's all it is. A little pen, sort of disembodied hand, a bit like a thing from the Addams Family. No, I don't expect either Anna or indeed Tosin or indeed Amanda to have ever heard of the Addams Family either. Hannah, maybe. I don't know. What the heck? Or as Lurch might say, will you be coming back, Randy? Will you be back in the not-too-distant future, maybe immediately after Thanksgiving?
Yes, I think I'll need a coat. I'll have to come to Lincoln to have one.
Well, that's true. That's exactly so. And yes, we've had several changes in line management, etc. But as I say, I think this campaign, which starts now and again, I mean, we'll get Darren on the case now, because Darren and myself are now in the same school, actually. We're in the School of Film, Media and Journalism.
Yes, we are.
So, yeah, we're not kind of, you know, separate. We're now collectively
even
together.
Even happier family than we were before.
Always. Exactly so. And Jean, will you be kind enough to return as well?
I love coming and talking to you, Alec, and the whole group. So I will come back anytime you ask.
We'll try and get Martin Scorsese on next, basically, as well, and see if he's actually around.
Get his name right.
I'm just saying what his film editor actually said, and that was relayed through the system. Apparently, we've all been guilty of mispronouncing Scorsese. You know, years of the whole system. Hannah, enjoy Sister Act with your mum. I'm sure it's going to be wonderful from that point of view. Who's going to be looking after Ray when you go off? I mean, are you taking Ray with you?
Oh, she will be chilling at home. She's not into the theatre.
No, I appreciate that. It's very important. And Jean, of course, a plug for, yes, the Mark Zuckerberg place that's called Facebook, which is still hosting the Jean Bruce Scott archive, and long may continue. Pretty much every Friday, there's some good news being posted there, I presume. Yeah, this is what it's all
every,
about.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we post something.
Yeah.
We have new interviews being done by Mark J. Carnes from Ireland. So we have a whole new season of those. There'll be 10 of them. And we're in the process of recording another 10. So we'll have ultimately 3 seasons of interviews.
We need to return and do another in-depth Resonance Rewind look at one of those episodes. I think we need to look at that. Either Airwolf or Magnum PI or something along the base. We'll have to look towards that, which is great. Okay, up next we have Dame Kelly Holmes. We'll be talking about the perimenopause. I'll say that again. Dame Kelly Holmes, Olympic athlete and gold medaling winning person, talking about perimenopause. All this on the Midweek Drive live. One of the things about achieving legendary status is that hopefully you've got something to say about life as you become more experientially enhanced, as you become more chronologically gifted, and simply go through the processes of life and the changes of life, etc. So when we're talking about the menopause in particular, who better to actually talk about the way in which maybe a number of firms are actually just effectively not managing this natural aspect of their staff as effectively as they could be. We're delighted to welcome, of course, Dame Kelly Holmes to the programme. How are you, Kelly?
Oh, I'm good, Alex. Thank you very much for having me on.
Excellent. It's great to connect with your good self, obviously, as I said, clearly a legend. But were you surprised by the findings of this, that actually 1 in 4 women in the UK have considered leaving their jobs because of the menopause?
Well, I mean, what a stat. But I kind of got to know about the fact that stat is absolutely true, but also that women have in the past left their jobs because of this peri and menopause conversation, which I was not aware of. And it's been enlightening to know that so many women have suffered in the past, never got support, and actually companies are so far behind on all of this conversation.
Now, one of the key things, of course, is that there is a company that's actually looking to push for more recognition and support for women experiencing menopausal symptoms at work, and that's Welltech company and supplement specialist Lima. Can you just share with us your own path, obviously, from a gold medal winning Olympic athlete, etc., when actually you're at the top of your game, etc.? Was this a case of you sort of, what on earth's happening to our body now?
Oh, absolutely. I've been in tune with my body for many, many years, and I've always been in denial of age. And, you know, I thought menopause was just always for old people, your mother, your grandmother, you know, you just don't really associate it with yourself as a person. And then I got to a point where a couple of years, well, last year and mainly earlier this year, really, I suppose, I was getting really extreme body pains, like really bad. And I thought, okay, this isn't getting an injury or having like delayed onset muscle syndrome after training hard. This is something worse. And I got to a point where I couldn't even do a press up at one set. I just went, nah, this isn't right. And at the same time, I was already experiencing insomnia, which I didn't know was a symptom of the perimenopause. You know, my sleeping patterns were bad. I was waking up in the middle of the night. I was getting more frustrated. Brain fog is definitely being a big thing. And then obviously it's come to light more with conversation and hearing great people speaking about it. I thought, oh my gosh, maybe I am. And now I realize, yep, I'm going through perimenopause. But I was really naive to the symptoms. I really didn't know, because I used to hear my mom, you know, talk about hot flushes, and some of my friends who well, either around my age or a couple of years older, and I used to think, oh God, here you go, I'm not your age, you know, they're sitting there and they're perspiring, they're going bright red and the thing, and we're all having a laugh, hey, going through the change. No one really knew what that meant until we do more of this and we realize the impact it's having on women.
I think, again, looking at the figures, 13 million people are estimated by the NHS to actually be perimenopausal or menopausal in the UK. That's a third of the population. That's an awful lot of prospective talent that if we don't understand the symptoms and the challenges, etc., we lost the workplace completely.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the fact, you know, 1 billion women will be going through menopause by 2025. And yet, at the moment, it's still being ignored by employers. People aren't being diagnosed properly. There isn't enough advice and support. And you mentioned Lima, who I'm working with. They have created a free menopause guide for employers and women in business. And it includes information on how to develop a policy. I mean, I couldn't believe, like, the amount of companies that I speak to around the world that do not have a policy in place for menopause, because as you rightly said, talent gets lost. Because if a woman goes into a workplace in their prime of working life and they are struggling with all of these symptoms that they're one unaware of, but two contribute to maybe another factor, it makes them feel lacking of confidence, feeling like they can't do their job, worried what people are going to think about them, worried about the perception if they go and ask, don't know who to ask, they either leave their job or something really bad happens in their own life. You know, it affects them so badly. You know, you hear people say, I hear women say, I thought I was losing the plot, you know, and they've gone to the doctor, they get diagnosed with depression. And actually what it is, it's a part of a menopausal symptoms around anxiety. Had they been advised on the right a medical pathway or supplementation to take, it could have alleviated a huge amount of those problems.
Now, the government obviously has a menopausal champion that's actually been charged with actually addressing the issue of normalising menopause in the workplace. It's Helen Tomlinson. I understand, obviously, the government have got lots of other challenges that they're working through. Do you think that's also a start, Kelly, in terms of at least beginning to raise this aspect, and together with Lima, together with yourself, etc., we will actually start beginning to see this is more than just, as you said, oh, it's just the hot flushes.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think, you know, organisations and campaigns like Lima, we've got to contact the government menopause employment champion to drive this, to make sure that they realise that this cannot be left unheard now, you know, because at the end of the day, what has to be put in place is one, the policies, but some organisations could help with occupational health by offering free subsidised maybe counselling, or provide a plan, flexi working, including home and hybrid working. But all of this needs to be ongoing discussion. So the person that is the government champion, as you mentioned, the government has so many other things, they've got to take this seriously, because this is half our workforce, you know, and you can lose huge talent. And also companies are going to be affected by losing that talent that they might have invested in the past. So that if we take this seriously and we really put in these policies and this conversation, I do believe this could be a game changer for industries, but also women's health and understanding and partnerships and relationships. You know, so many effects on this through a natural part of our life that we are out of control. It controls us, but we can put in a process to help ourselves, but we also need that help from others. So I think this conversation is vital.
You're an Olympic champion, as we said, Kelly. How does Britain compare with other countries, or is it a case of, I really don't know, I'm only concerned about Britain and in this particular instance? So are we ahead of the game, do you think, or is it a case of, no, we still got a lot of catching up to do?
Well, there's the thing. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of companies that do and don't. And when I speak around the world, every company is at different stages of every discussion, whether that's, I don't know, diversity and inclusion, whether that's mental health awareness, whether that's well-being, et cetera, or, you know, equality and gender equality. You know, everyone is at different stages, but all I do know is that I have a voice here in the UK. I've got a great organization behind and organizations that I've been working with who are up the top of their game, who want to make a difference. And it's and I am in the public eye. I feel it's not just a responsibility. It's something I want to do. I want to have a voice for other people. This is affecting me. I know it affects so many others. And so I want to be one of the drivers for change.
Indeed, we're still on the journey. Finally, Kelly, where can people actually find out further details about Lima and indeed the things we've been discussing today?
Well, it's Lima, but it's spelled L-Y-M-A, but it's lima.life, and there's a journal section and you can find out more about the menopause guide through that.
Dame Kelly Holmes, legendary Olympic champion, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Drifting in its wake, but both ways by the choice.
Tosin, are you looking forward to seeing October Girl performed live in person in the Cargo Lecture Theatre on the evening of Saturday, November the 25th?
Yes, finally. It's been done. I can't wait.
It will be. Anna, are you looking forward to seeing October Girl performed live by the singer and writer in the Cargo Lecture Theatre on November 25th?
Of course. As I said before, I'm going to be front row.
Front row.
With singing October Girl with all my outs.
It's an exclusive performance, only 150. Astonishingly, Victoria Simmons is with us now. Victoria, welcome back to the Midweek Drive Live. How's the day been working with that character that we can't really speak about, but it's Peppa Pig, whatever?
Oh, it's been good. If I take this out, it might be better because you didn't hear me well yesterday.
Yesterday was another lifetime away, Victoria. We're here now. We've been through a lot since then. You know, we've been through the notion of Jessica Burtis being poorly, so we have to summarise the show between Anna and myself. Anna said, "Can't Victoria do it?" I said, "No, she's working." So I said, "Okay, Anna, I'll help you through this." In the first quarter, we featured, of course, our disgraced academic Professor Jonathan Pruitt, who managed to show how, even with his academic scandals that were a lot less scandalous than maybe we'd originally thought they would have been, perhaps it's all down to perspective, he's relaunching his career very successfully. Anna Lewis joined us from London. And in the studio, of course, we had the welcome return of Darren Scales, Ace. Well, how would you describe yourself, Darren? Just Ace.
Filmmaker, confused, and lover of all things sci-fi.
Did you enjoy October Girl?
That was amazing. I was just saying, it sounds very Bond. I don't know if that was the intent, but I definitely had I was expecting Alex to say, yes, this is the latest exclusive for the next Bond movie. And I was like, well, I would have believed it. I hope that's a compliment. It's meant to be. I found it very, very, it's my kind of music, so I definitely liked it.
Will you be coming to the concert then?
I'm going to now.
You're going to be front row with us.
Absolutely. I'm going to light my phone up and everything when that comes on, definitely,
And we also had Amanda Jones coming back to the studio. It's all right, basically. I know she came packed with lots of questions for you, Victoria. You're going to have to postpone it. Don't worry, Amanda. Anyway, Amanda, did you enjoy October Girl?
Don't worry.
It was lovely. Honestly, I just, for some reason, my mind instantly drifted off to pumpkin spice latte. So I'm like, okay, when I get home, I'm going to dim the light in the kitchen, in the living room, have that song playing, pretend that I have my own little cafe store.
Who would have thought, Victoria?
It's a shame because I don't actually pay that certain pig today. Mm. I play a sweet corn that is matched with a pumpkin.
Nice.
And it's a vocal immersive theatre thing. Yeah. And all the time, every time somebody comes up to us with a coffee, we say, I hope it's not a pumpkin spice latte.
Of course.
So you just saying that is
twisting the knife, isn't it, really? I think it's something in sort of the statistic side of a creative writer. Never mind. Sophie Kay, of course, joined us in the second quarter, as Jessica would have said, with news, of course, her band Sophie and the Sticks. We heard her latest release, Square One, which went down pretty well, actually. I think we will give it another airing probably next week. Randy Reinholtz was with us, of course, from San Diego. So was Jean Bruce Scott, and they regaled us with tales of how, yes, they had picked up on the probably Academy Award winning incarnation of Martin Scorsese's latest movie, of course, the Native American actress Lily Gladstone, and indeed she'd worked with them in the Native American Voices back in the day. Hannah O'Brien shared with us her tales of her cat Ray, who was having challenges with respect to diets and such like, and was probably in the cat's doghouse, if that's not an oxymoron. Dame Kelly Holmes, we just heard in the final quarter, discussing the perimenopause. So, Anna, who gets the Most Valuable Contributor Award? Of course, we haven't left out Victoria. She's also with us as well. That's 14 individual features. So
4 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Who gets that particular award?
Well, I think I'm going to give it to Sophie Kay and her band. And I'm going to reiterate something that Amanda said when she was talking to Sophie. We were talking about her song, and Amanda said that her song made her think about how we measure time through relationships. And I don't know, that for me made it the MVP.
There you go. Most Valuable Contributor goes to Sophie Kay of the band Sophie and the Sticks.
I will be looking out for that.
Yeah. She left because she said she couldn't compete with you, Victoria. It's all right. It's important. Anyway. Okay, Victoria, very briefly, how do people actually very shortly, because I think we're looking to launch this next week on our chocolate tasting special of the Midweek Drive Live. How do they actually start looking at booking tickets through Eventbrite for Saturday, November the 25th?
You haven't told me how they book tickets.
Oh, okay, well, there will be the answers will be made. It will be via Eventbrite. £10 will get you the actual ticket that you need. That's all you need for that sort of thing. There are only 150 available, so you're going to have to move very rapidly. So it's an exclusive performance. Get a chance to meet you afterwards, of course, Victoria and Chloe Rose.
Yay!
Yep, so it's all important from that
point
of view.
That's the best part.
And all sorts of other things that's taking place at the University of Lincoln on campus on the 25th of November, Saturday, in the Cargill Lecture Theatre. What a perfect way to spend Saturday night.
They can go onto Instagram at official_Victoria_music, and there'll be every piece of information as it comes up.
Exactly, which again, we're launching through that point of view. Great. Darren, have you enjoyed being back on the Midweek Drive Live?
I've had an amazing time. Thank you for having me back. It's been great.
I mean, there was a moment where you thought, is it all on Zoom? Not anymore.
I know.
It's kind of a hybrid. Hybrid. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's great.
All good stuff there. And Amanda, good to see you back again. Are you going to come back sometime?
Yeah, I will do.
Oh, that's all right then. Very good. Anna, you're a fixture now, basically. You carved out this whole routine. Do you think your mum would have liked tonight's show? I mean, do you think she would she have agreed with your choice, or would she really have said, no, I think you should have given it to that nice Dame Kelly Holmes?
Oh, well, I surely hope so. I haven't heard from her, so I'm going to ask her and let you know next week.
She's ghosting you then, obviously. She just
oh, Jesus.
Well, exactly.
Not again.
These sort of problems. Not again. Romanian parental challenges. This is a whole new world. And Tosin, Afrobeats, of course, on this Sunday, usual time.
7 to 9 p.m. if you don't to listen to some African music and just... Forgive me.
Yeah. You should do an Afrobeat version of Victoria's music. I think that's
okay.
Yeah.
Victoria, you don't. You don't.
Yeah, you can. I'll send you a track, and you can
mix.
Yeah, put the drums and everything.
However you like.
Okay.
We can have a karaoke night or a series at the concert.
Yeah,
it's just like a whole new era of creativity, Daz.
Yeah. All for that. Yeah,
exactly.
Awesome.
It's working on that system. To you, dear listener, keep on keeping on. Up next, we've got Early Nights with Callum. It's time for us to say farewell. So let's say it after three. One, two, three.
Farewell.
Farewell. Farewell.